Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
From KQED.
And remember, now I'm doing D.C., New York, Atlanta, Denver. I'm fundraising everywhere in the country. Wow. So,
but you got your private jet, right?
Right.
Hey, everyone. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Guy Marzorati, in for Scott Schaefer. Today on The Breakdown, Congresswoman Barbara Lee. She's represented Oakland and the East Bay in the House for decades. Now she's running for the U.S. Senate.
We are thrilled to have her with us today. Our latest interview with one of the candidates hoping to claim the seat held for more than 30 years by the late Dianne Feinstein. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, welcome back to The Breakdown.
Happy to be here.
Well, thank you for coming in. You know, we wanted to start with a little bit of your background. And I was in L.A. Monday night at the debate. And you were asked during the debate, who's the person who shaped your worldview? And you talked about your late mother, Mildred Parrish Massey. Tell us a little bit about her and your relationship.
Boy, first of all, I really miss her.
Yeah.
She was born in El Paso, Texas. She had two sisters, so three girls in a household, and then my mother had three girls.
Oh, wow.
And my poor grandfather.
Yeah, right.
But he was so much of a, quote, feminist in the day that my mother and my two aunts were. Mm-hmm. And my mother was one who took no prisoners. She was very kind, very quiet, but very tough. And she was actually the first black female to work as a civilian employee at Fort Bliss, Texas. Hmm. Also, she was one of the 12 plaintiffs in the lawsuit put forth by the NAACP to integrate, then it was Texas Western, now the University of Texas at El Paso.
Well, yeah, we found this incredible photo. This is from the Texas State Historical Association. I wonder if you've seen this before. If you can tell us, maybe this is the Texas Western days, or...
That's her. That was probably before Texas Western.
Okay.
Because I was really young, but I was alive when she did. I think that was in the...
Because she was a little older. She had gone to an HBCU,
yeah,
and then...
Yeah, she went to Southern University.
Okay.
And Prairie View for a while, and then came back to El Paso.
Right.
And can I have this?
Oh, of course.
Oh, God, that's my mommy.
And tell
and
us
she was beautiful, too.
Yeah.
I mean, look, yeah, that photo. I mean, tell us a little bit about how she talked to you and your sisters about, you know, living in the Jim Crow South. I know she dealt with segregation even at your birth, right?
Yeah, yeah. When she was pregnant, she needed a C-section. And she went to it. The hospital's not there now, but it was Hotel Dew Hospital. Ironically, it was a Catholic hospital. And they would not let her in because she was black. Mm-hmm. And so how she got in was really a story in itself, because my grandmother, her father was Irish. And you talk about domestic abuse and rape of black women. She worked, my grandmother's mother worked in the household of an Irish family. Wow. And he raped her. Out of that rape came my grandmother. And so my grandmother looked like she was white. And so she came to at the hospital. She said, this is my daughter. And, you know, and my mother, everyone in El Paso knows the story. My mother had green eyes and she was very fair, but, you know, they knew that she had black blood. And so my grandmother had to say, this is my daughter, let her in. And so they let my mother in, thinking that maybe this looked like a white woman. It really was her daughter, but, you know, so be it. Mm-hmm. But what happened was when they let her in, they did not take her in and provide medical care. They didn't monitor her. They did not even come to check her out. And they put her on a gurney in the hall. Mm-hmm. And it was too late for a C-section by the time someone noticed her. So finally, they pulled her in, and she said it was not the delivery room, but it was the emergency room, because she was dying. She was remember black maternal mortality rate now and infant mortality rate, three times that of white women. Bottom line is she became unconscious. She was dying. They didn't know what to do. They pulled her in to the emergency room and decided very quickly that they had to do something. And they ended up pulling me out using forceps, and I had a scar on my eye. I almost didn't breathe, and my almost mother died in childbirth. So that's kind of how I came into this world, almost not getting here, almost not being able to breathe. My mother almost died, and that's my beginning of my fight for justice, for health care, and for shattering discrimination and racism wherever it occurs, because I knew that story as a child, and I love my mother, and I couldn't figure out my mommy, and I called her mommy, why they would do this to my mommy. Until I, you know, it was really traumatic to know that my mother almost died and I almost didn't get in this world.
Wow, that's pretty incredible, too, that you grew up knowing about it, knowing, you know, that they talked about it. I mean, you had what seems like a sort of chaotic childhood in some ways. I think your mom was married three times. How did that impact you? Because you guys moved around. Her third husband, right, was in the military. Yeah.
But we didn't move around. That was one thing about my mother. She was determined we were going to have a stable life. Yeah. And so she and my biological father broke up and she remarried, but we still stayed in El Paso. And so they decided that no more segregation, that even though the black school where she attended, Douglas School, was the best in the city, but they decided that that was participating in segregation. And so no more of that. So my grandfather acted with the NAACP. My mother, you know, not necessarily an activist, but telling us, you're equal, regardless of whether you're a girl and whether you're black, you're equal to anybody. And so they put us in Catholic school, and we were the only one more black girl, maybe toward the end of the eighth grade.
Now, was that a girl's school? Was that nuns?
There were nuns, Sisters of Loretta. Wasn't okay. A girl's school, though.
Was it hard being the only black kids there?
Oh, it was really hard because, first of all, no black history was taught. Secondly, a bit of history, when it talked about slavery, the way the books were written, it was so demeaning, like slaves became slaves because they wanted to be slaves and they were lazy. And so everyone in the class would always look at me like, oh, really? You know, that's who you are? You know, so it was really awful. But the nuns, to their credit, they were the Sisters of Loretta. They tried to get my classmates to stop that. And they paid a lot of attention to me. And I still have a letter from my music teacher, Ms. Buchanan, who was an Irish-American woman, who was the sister of the Monsignor there. And she wrote me this letter when I was in my 20s. And she said, you know, Barbara, she said, you were the shyest person, but the smartest person in the class. And she said, and all of us as your teachers knew that, and we were so sorry that we didn't present being enslaved as a, you know, the total picture of it and why that happened. And so the teachers knew that. And so that stayed with me.
I bet, yeah.
They saw something in you, yeah.
Yeah, they saw something in me. And it was so nice to get that letter in my 20s saying how shy I was, how they loved me, and they were determined. And I got almost all A's. I mean, I have all these certificates. I was the best speller, spelling bee certificates. I mean, my mother and my grandfather, my dad, you better be an A student. I mean, you know, you've got to work harder than all those other kids. You've got to prove yourself. You know, so, you know.
That's the expectation. Totally.
Yeah. Well, practice the piano, and I was took piano lessons, too, every Saturday.
Well, eventually your family moved to California, moved to the San Fernando Valley, and you became the first black cheerleader at San Fernando High. How did it happen?
Oh, my gosh. We thought when we moved to California, and we moved to California primarily because of the public schools. It was the best. We had the best public schools here in California then. And that was the primary reason we moved from Texas to Southern California. I wanted to be a cheerleader, so I went to San Fernando Junior High, San Fernando High School. But there was this selection criteria that cheerleaders had to go through. So I didn't look like I could meet that criteria, because look at me. And No. And I really wanted to be a cheerleader. And I couldn't figure out why this process was there that kept me from being a cheerleader. So I went to the NAACP. I was on work study. And my boss was a member. He was the president of the NAACP, Pacoima Memorial Lutheran Credit Union. And they looked at it. And Mr. Mance, he said, okay, yeah, you're right. And helped me organize the student body and the administration. A lot of pushback. But finally, I was able to get that selection process turned into an election. And so I tried out in front of the student body. And guess what? I won. I did my cartwheels, my splits, the whole nine yards. I was the first girl black cheerleader at San Fernando High School. But also that broke the barrier for other black and brown girls.
And you all stay in touch at all?
Every now and then at a reunion, like Joy Reed, I remember Joy, I see her. And yeah, during our high school reunions we do, but not daily or weekly or even yearly. But it was great. Yeah. And but that was the first election. I was 15 years old, and I won that election. And
first
I intend
of many.
To win. I
yeah.
intend to win this one too.
All right, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Democratic Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who's running for U.S. Senate. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. Marisa Lagos here with Guy Marzorati. Today we're speaking with Oakland Congresswoman Barbara Lee. She has held that seat since 1998 and is now running for U.S. Senate. You know, Congresswoman, one story, you know, you've talked about pretty openly in the past few years since the Dobbs decision is your own experience getting an abortion in Mexico as a teenager. I wonder if you could just briefly share a little bit about that experience and kind of how it influenced your political positions in life.
Sure, this was before Roe, and I never talked about it because just like now, this is a personal decision. It's nobody's business, so why do I need to talk about it? So with personal decisions that people make about their own bodies, still to this day, it's a personal decision. It's not the court's decision. It's not my decision. It's not an elected official's decision. No one. And if you want to keep it private, you do. If you don't, you don't have to. So bottom line is we kept it private. Before Roe, of course, I was in the Valley, San Fernando Valley, and got pregnant. And my mother and I decided that the best thing for me was to have an abortion. And I was terrified, but I knew that was the right decision. But it was illegal. She sent me to her friend in El Paso, who was a Latina. Her best friend was a Latina then. Who took me over to Juarez, and there was a back alley, and her friend knew this doctor. Mm-hmm. And it was late at night, and I'll never forget going down that alley into this clinic. There were lights above, and the doctor had on a white jacket, and I was terrified because I knew I could be put in jail. First of all, just like now, could be criminal, being criminalized, can be put in jail, and I knew that I could die because the death rate for black girls then was the highest death rate was because of septic abortions. And so I was terrified. But by the grace of God, I made it and lived through that. But when I left that alley, that clinic, I went back into Texas, into El Paso, then back to California. I was terrified because getting on a plane and it's illegal in Texas and illegal in California. They're going to arrest me there just like now. And so after the Texas decision came down, a couple of years ago, restricting abortion, I said, it's time. You know, women need to know that there are members of Congress who understand that, who see them, who understand that they're fighting for their reproductive freedom. And so I talked about it. And let me tell you, it was really something. So many men came to me and told me that their girlfriends had had abortions. So many men came and said their wives had had abortions. Some said their girlfriends and their wives had abortions. And so it opened up another level of dialogue. But I was co-chairing the pro-choice caucus then, and I've always been a fighter to end the Hyde Amendment. I've always been out
different
there.
Different when you're talking about
when you're talking
your
about yourself. So it was real. That was another moment for me. It took a lot out of me because, you know, I was raised a Catholic. You know, I'm a progressive Baptist now, member of Allen Temple Baptist Church with a great pastor, Jacqueline Thompson, very progressive church. She's a very progressive black woman preacher. And so I'm a woman of faith. And so the, you know, the struggles you go through, everyone goes through whatever struggles they have. But bottom line, it was a private decision. And I felt like, no way do I need to talk about it. But after those court decisions, I felt it was time. And now I'm glad I did, because I'm talking more about it. It's still a little hard. But, you know, now it's important for everyone to know that I'm going to win the Senate seat, and I want to work to make sure we codify into federal law the Women's Health Protection Act and in the Hyde Amendment, because that still, even for young women in states where abortion is still legal, it denies access to abortion care, primarily for low-income women who are primarily black and brown.
And we should
women.
Say that's the amendment that essentially bars federal money from being used for an abortion, so anyone on Medi-Cal or one of those programs.
Yeah.
You've also been open talking about your experience in, with homelessness. And this came up in the debate on Monday, and I think you had a visceral reaction when another candidate, Steve Garvey, talked about touring homeless encampments, touching, listening to people there. What was going through your mind as you were listening to that Monday?
I had to hold back. I didn't want to appear the angry black woman, right? You know, black women have these issues with perception in the media and how people see you. So I'm saying, okay, now this man is wrong. He's being patronizing. He's being insensitive. And what's he doing running for the Senate, all of a sudden recognizing that people are unsheltered and then talking about touching them? And it was just outrageous. And so I had to just call him on it. And I'm glad I did, because I hope people understand that it's important to address the issue of homelessness, people being unhoused and unsheltered, and adding a lens of experience gives you an opportunity to weigh in on policies that can work. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine someone like Mr. Garvey in the Senate? All he could say is that he would ask for an audit. Come on. You know, this is a crisis.
Well, I want to skip forward a little bit to when you got involved in politics, but we should tell our listeners, I mean, you had a pretty remarkable early adulthood. You had two kids, I think, by age 20. You ended up putting yourself through college. I think for a while, your kids were in Texas, which must have been really difficult, being taken care of, you know, by family members. But after college, you end up getting involved with the Black Panthers, and you were the fundraising coordinator for Bobby Seale's 1973 campaign for mayor. What's your favorite memory from that campaign? That must have been quite,
must have some good stories.
Quite a experience.
Well, this was during my college days. I was Black Student Union president at Mills College, and then went on to UC Berkeley. Go Bears! And got my MSW. I think one of the most memorable, I have two really great stories. One was Huey Newton. I worked with Huey and Bobby Seale and Elaine Brown, and the Black Panther Party had not been involved in politics. And of course, I got involved in politics through Shirley Chisholm's campaign. So I went to Huey Newton and I said, you know, it would be great if the Black Panther Party could get involved in Shirley Chisholm's campaign and voter registration. And I said, and you know, and he didn't know Shirley. So I said, we're doing a fundraiser for Shirley Chisholm at Diane Carroll's house in Los Angeles or in Beverly Hills or wherever it was. And so why don't you come down with me and meet Shirley Chisholm? So he did. And the person who opened the door was Maxine Waters. That's how I met Maxine Waters. But what happened was I introduced Huey Newton to Shirley Chisholm, and they got along like you would not believe. And they endorsed Shirley Chisholm. And she said, yes, I accept the endorsement of the Black Panther Party. I wish we didn't have a need for the Black Panther Party. And then I coordinated and organized a fundraiser at Huey's Place, 1200 Lakeshore in Oakland, and for Shirley Chisholm. So that was a big deal, Barbara Lee organizing Black Panther Party fundraiser for Shirley Chisholm. The other was during Bobby Seale's campaign for mayor. I was his fundraising coordinator. And we raised money for Bobby Seale for mayor. He got into the runoff. But in addition to that, I was a precinct captain. And it was during that time I learned why grassroots organizing, especially in local elections, is so important. I remember my precinct in West Oakland, went from door to door, talking to people, phoning people. And I learned during that campaign for Bobby, and he taught us a lot about organizing and about a people-powered campaign and what it means if you don't have a lot of money, but it's people that are the most important aspect of a campaign, to communicate to people and get them to vote for you. And that's what we did. And he got into the runoff.
And you mentioned Shirley Chisholm. You've called her a mentor. You worked on her 72 presidential campaign. What is it that you learned from her that maybe you still keep with you today?
Shirley Chisholm said to me, and I was like young people now, not wanting to register to vote and not believing the two-party system was working to help me or had any relationship to my life. So she said, no. She said, you have got to register to vote. Get in there and shake things up. She said, you cannot go along to get along because these rules and laws weren't made for you and they weren't made for me. So get in there and shake things up. And also, let me just give a plug for the movie. It's coming out March 22nd, Shirley, on Netflix. And there's a character in the movie, Barbara Lee. So, and I went on set. Regina King is playing Shirley Chisholm. And Christina Jackson is playing Barbara Lee. And that's going to be on March 22nd. And I was like, oh my God. Please.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. Marisa Lagos here with Guy Marzorati, our guest today, Congresswoman Barbara Lee. Well, let's talk about your time in Congress, or some of it. I mean, you were elected in 98 after Ron Dellums resigned. Kind of haven't had a hard election since. You've really represented that district for a long time. And, you know, you've talked about this a lot, but you were really our best known, I would say, for your 2001 vote against authorizing military force after 9/11. I'm curious, like, I think, you know, people who have heard you talk understand the sort of moral and policy reasons, but I'm wondering on a personal level, was that a tough vote? Like, what was the reaction from, you know, your colleagues in Congress? I mean, were you getting a lot of pressure?
It was a very tough vote. And I didn't come to that decision lightly. I actually went back and looked at our Constitution. I read the authorization, tried to get them to narrow it. It was a 60-word, overly broad authorization that gave then-President Bush and any president subsequent to that the authority to go to war without coming to Congress. I said, wait a minute. And then I looked at, and my dad, remember, was in the military. He said, you know, and after I voted no, he was the first one to call me and said, that was the right vote. Don't you send our troops in harm's way, and you don't know what you're doing. This was 3 days after the horrific attacks. And then my social work clinical background came into play. Psychology 101, you don't make hard decisions when you're mourning, when you're grieving, when you're angry. The country was in mourning. We were grieving. My district director's cousin was killed in Flight 93. I was sitting in the Capitol. That plane was coming into the Capitol. We were told I had to evacuate. So just know a lot was going on personally.
Like, it was visceral
with me.
For
it
you.
Was
yeah,
very
and
visceral.
All of
so it was
members,
really
probably.
Hard. And I went to the memorial service, and I just recently met him. Bishop Nathan Baxter was the dean of the National Cathedral, and he said, as we act, let us not become the evil that we deplore. And I wrote that down, and that settled it for me. And when I voted no, my colleagues tried to get me to change my vote. But it was out of friendship. It wasn't like, how dare you? It
they were probably like, worried about you.
They were. They said, you're going to get killed. Your family's going to get killed. They're going to come after you. And then one said, look, you're doing all this great work with HIV and AIDS. Because I remember I was lived on PEPFAR and got George Bush to follow my lead to help address the global HIV AIDS pandemic. They said, you're doing so much work on so many fronts. You can't leave this place. You're going to lose your election. So it was out of friendship. And so, and my mother parenthetically said, I should have told them that when you make your mind up, you're kind of stubborn, but you think it through. It's not like a quick decision that right. she makes. So my mother said I could have told them. So, yeah, so it was very hard. And then you know what happened afterwards. I mean, my opponent went to New York and walked in the Veterans Day parade with Rudy Giuliani, walking in that parade with a sign, my face smiling, World Trade Towers burning in the background, saying Barbara Lee hates America. And so that was so hard, being called a traitor, unpatriotic. And it taught me one thing, though. A lot of people don't know that central to our democracy is the right to dissent and to have a different point of view and to say no when you think it's wrong. I mean, why am I yeah. elected? Right.
Talk to my kids
leave?
About that a right. lot. Yeah.
Well, fast forward to this U.S. Senate race, and the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza has taken a central role. And you were early calling for a ceasefire. I'm sure you see parallels between, you know, America after 9/11 and the situation Israel's in now.
After 9/11, I said in my speech on the floor, it could spiral. It's going to spiral out of control if we don't do something, and if we don't be rational in our response. Fast forward to now. Yeah, I called for a ceasefire early. I condemned the Hamas attacks. I condemned terrorism. No country, including Israel, should be in the middle of the kind of insecurity. As it relates to worrying constantly about terrorist attacks. So make no mistake, you know, Hamas is a terrorist organization, which I condemn and will continue to condemn. I also know that what is taking place by killing 25,000 plus civilians is counterproductive to Israel's security. Mm. And I know that. And so I called for a ceasefire. The only way you're going to get a pathway to a two-state solution and to security and peace for the Israelis and the Palestinians is a permanent ceasefire now.
Can I ask you, though, Katie Porter at the debate said ceasefire is not a magic word. You can't just say it and it'll happen. What do you see as the path towards a permanent yeah. ceasefire?
It's not a magic word. You have to negotiate a ceasefire. And that's what I'm talking about, because what you see right now is, as I said, after 9/11, it could spiral out of control. You see a regional war breaking out. Now, that's in our own national security, within our own national security concern. We should be concerned about what is taking place right now. And so Secretary Blinken, I mean, there, you know, getting the region to come together to negotiate a ceasefire, that has to happen. And I'm not talking about, you can't put, like Ms. Porter, Congresswoman Porter, conditions on, because those conditions will never be met. You negotiate a political and diplomatic solution, because once again, it's not in Israel's security interests, let alone the Palestinians, to allow this to keep going yeah. the way it's going. And it's a humanitarian catastrophe.
We're short on time. I do want to ask you finally, in like the final minute, you know, you're the oldest Democrat competing for the seat, the only woman of color. There's been a lot of talk, especially in the left, your progressive base, about generational change. What's the pitch to people who wonder about your age?
Well, the pitch is, one, you need somebody in the Senate who's going to fight for you and who's going to make life better and who's had the experience as a negotiator, legislator, appropriator, and who's a leader. And when you look at what I have done in terms of leadership, you need somebody who's going to hit the ground running. You don't need anybody who's just going through on-the-job training, for instance, on foreign policy. You don't need anyone who just recently has started fighting for our democracy. I've been fighting for democracy and our freedoms all my life. And so this is a very dangerous time in terms of our democracy. And as a black woman, come on, representation does matter. Since 1789, when the first Senate went into session, we've had three black women serving a total of 10 years. Imagine what this country has lost. So, yeah, I want to be your next senator, and I want to fight for you to make life better, to reduce the cost of living, to address the climate crisis, to address affordable housing. And I ask you to go to BarbaraLeeForCA.com.
All right. We're going to leave it there, Congresswoman. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That will do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. We're a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our engineer today is Christopher Beal. Our producer is Izzy Bloom. I'm Guy Marzorati.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. We'll be back with more candidate interviews in the coming weeks. See you next time.